This is the Marketplace Morning Report. I'm David Brancaccio. Would you say that the world of finance and markets needs a good infusion of humanity? Well, let me give you a taste of a fascinating book about how a wider reading of the humanities can help you understand finance, and at the same time, how finance can help you understand the human condition. It's by economist and Harvard Business School professor Mihir Desai. Professor, thank you for joining us.
Great to be here.
I got to be blunt to start. Finance needs to discover some humanity, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. I think the humanities have something to say because it's filled with stories. So if you start to look at these underlying ideas, if you are a practitioner of finance, through a moral lens and through stories, then these ideas resonate in a new way. And if you're outside finance, the best way to learn it is not through equations or graphs. Many people find that intimidating. It's through stories.
All right, so let's try here. So the humanities can be a teaching tool for understanding things that might seem boring, but actually guide our lives at different levels. I'm thinking, reading the book, insurance. Really? Insurance?
Yeah, I mean, insurance is the most mundane thing for most people in the world. What's wonderful about insurance, as I was writing the book, I came to realize that, you know, risk and insurance are the core of finance. And it turns out that risk and insurance are the core of a lot of people's lives. And in fact, the story I tell is the story of Charles Peirce, who's this remarkable philosopher and the founder of pragmatism, who ends up at the end of his life going around the country saying, "We are all insurance companies," which is very jarring to everybody, and they think he's crazy.
I know he gives a lecture at Harvard, and people are like, oh, this guy's lost it.
And then Peirce shows up, he gives this lecture, and he's deriving the first order conditions for pricing insurance policies, and everybody thinks he's completely crazy. But what he understood is that the problem of an insurance company is the problem of a human being, which is there's chaos and there's randomness in the world, and you have to figure out how to navigate it. And pragmatism is the philosophy which says, go out and sample, get experience, don't introspect. And that is exactly what insurance companies do. So that's the sense in which he meant it, as we are all insurance companies. In that chapter, I also tell the story of Wallace Stevens, who's an amazing American poet from the last century. He, too, spent his life in insurance. He was offered a professorship of poetry at Harvard. He said, no, I want to keep working at the Hartford, which, you know, to most people is absolutely incredible. But he actually says, you know, poetry and surety claims, which is his version of insurance, are not that different at all. Because they're both about ordering the chaos you see in the world.
M&A, mergers and acquisitions, can inform our lives for a night out using the Tinder app?
Indeed. That's the cheekiest chapter of all, I think. The goal in that chapter is to say, let's look at mergers and then let's see if it might apply to marriages. So what do we know about mergers? Well, obviously, many fail. Synergies are always overestimated. You know, which is a way of saying you think you can change the other organization and quickly reap a lot of benefits from that change.
Yeah, my mother always says you can't change people.
Indeed. Integration planning is always underdone, right? You know, people talk about weddings. They don't talk about marriages. So there's about 8 or 9 of those. So that's clearly the cheekiest chapter, but it's meant to kind of get people to put two things in their mind together that would never otherwise be connected, which is romance and finance.
This really surprised me. The study of bankruptcy, you argue in the book, is clearly about how to deal with failure. But it's also about resolving, you say, conflicting commitments that we made. That is one of life's central challenges. And bankruptcy teaches about this?
I tell the story of American Airlines, which was the last airline to go bankrupt. And the first CEO said for a long time he'll never go bankrupt because it was his duty to make sure every obligation gets paid off. Of course, he gets dragged into bankruptcy at the very end. They switch the CEO. The second CEO comes in, restructures all the obligations, guts the pensions, but American Airlines goes on to live another day. So the idea there is, you know, who's the hero of that story? Is the guy who said, I have to stand by all my obligations, but took the company down, or the guy who said, I actually got to manage these conflicting obligations? I trace that and I make a correspondence between that and, you know, Martha Nussbaum's, you know, really remarkable work, The Fragility of Goodness, where she looks at all the Greek tragedies and she says, fundamentally, you know, this is about undercutting the idea that you have to follow duty. Most of Greek tragedies are about people who have these conflicting obligations and it's a mess and you have to navigate them. And she says that's a good life. If you don't have conflicting obligations, you're doing something wrong. So that's the sense in which bankruptcies are really illustrative, I think.
I mean, in the American Airlines example, you want the final grade as to who achieved the moral high ground kind of benefit net to society as opposed to the company lived.
Absolutely. And it's not clear, right? The nice thing about that story is it's not clear who's the hero. So the first CEO, Tom Arpe, you know, many people think of as the hero. And then the next one, Horton, I actually think is in some ways more heroic because he dealt with the mess and he got in there. And by the way, he's totally hated now by everybody. But one of the nice things I did is I talked to a former student of mine who's a pilot at American Airlines, Jim Dubla. And he, you know, I asked him, who is the hero of that story? And he was involved in the negotiations. And he said, you know, I used to think Arpe was the first CEO, but I've come to realize that maybe Horton was because he actually managed through all the muck. People liked Arpe, but in fact, Horton let them survive. So it's a very morally complex story. I don't try to come down and say who's right or wrong, but just to make the moral complexity of bankruptcy clear and this correspondence to these conflicting obligations of Greek tragedies.
And I had to chuckle. I imagined you either in a Broadway seat watching Mel Brooks, the producers, or maybe you're watching the movie in a movie theater, and you're getting a lesson in fiduciary responsibility.
Absolutely. So it was on a DVD, but indeed, so the 1968 version of the producers is a spectacular story. Bialystok and Bloom, of course, raised 25,000% of the money they need to do a show, aiming to purposefully fail. They end up producing Springtime for Hitler. They try desperately to make it fail by having the worst producer, the worst actors, the worst directors. It's a huge hit. And of course, they go to jail. The fabulous part of that story is that is the central problem of modern capitalism. Investors giving money to other people to manage and to run companies. The separation of ownership and control, the principal and agent problem, is the problem of modern capitalism. And that is a really nice insight on that. So what I do in that chapter is use that as a starting point to talk about that set of problems. I talk about Apple and David Einhorn and Tootsie Roll. But the whole goal is to get people to understand the deep problem of finance is when you give your capital to someone else, why do they ever give it back? And that's exactly the problem with the producers. And in the rest of the chapter, that turns out to be a powerful frame on your life, more generally.
This says something, though, about the arts, literature, people who make movies or theater, having some of the deepest insights about how the world works. Because you find these brainiacs in finance are missing something larger, by and large.
You know, I think increasingly we look to the social sciences for wisdom about how to be happy or how to do things. And in a way, this book is a little bit of a reaction against that. I think there's real wisdom in these stories. And in fact, they're not divorced from finance. And that should come as no surprise. I mean, the field of finance is interested in how value is created, how we measure value. And that is what a lot of the humanities are about.
The book is called The Wisdom of Finance, Discovering Humanity in the World of Risk and Return. The author is Harvard Business School Professor Mihir Desai. Professor, thank you.
Thanks so much.